Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. M.I. Wallach, producer and director of the documentary film Enter Here, the story of Ilya and Amelia Kabakov, is our guest in this edition of Radio Curious. M.I. Wallach met Ilya Kabakov in 1987 when she was in the Soviet Union investigating the effect of perestroika on the arts. Unavoidably intrigued, 8 years later, she published the first biography of Ilya Kabakov, The Man Who Never Threw Anything Away. Her documentary film, Enter Here, reveals not only the lives and work of Ilya and Amelia Kabakov, Russia's most celebrated international artists, who are now United States citizens, but also the lives of the average Russian from the Stalin era to the fall of the Soviet Union. Enter Here will be shown at the Mendocino Film Festival on May 31st, 2015, at 12:30 p.m. in the village of Mendocino, California. When Ame Wallach and I visited by phone on May 10th, 2015, she began with an explanation of how art outwits oppression.
Well, I think it does it in many ways. I mean, I think for an artist, it is a way of making sense of a senseless life. It is a way, as Ilya did, of organizing the true facts of what your life is and making it into something that transcends that. And I also think it is that for the viewer. I think art is the exact opposite of the mass movements clashing armies, violence of oppression. I think it is a present moment in time in which you can pause in this world that is a different world and have an experience that is different from the experiences that blight your world, or as a viewer, that take you away from a regard of what the world is like, and you can breathe. Suddenly you catch your breath and you can breathe.
Ame Wallach, your film Enter Here is about the lives of Ilya and Amelia Kabakov, Ilya's wife. Could you put the film in the context of the time of their lives?
Well, their time, of course, is a long time. Ilya was born on September 30th, 1933, and lives in Matatuck, New York, even as we speak. And Amelia was born a few years later, 12 years later, also in Russia, and lives in Matatuck, New York. So their time spans time and continents. So to talk about it, Ilya was born into Soviet Russia. I mean, worse than that, he was born into Stalin's Russia. His mother had a horrific life, which in backflash is part of the story and is also the source of much of the work that he makes. Amelia, as she says, was born basically at the end of the Stalin era. So she says, we were not in the Stalinist era. It was totally different. In the Stalin era, if you did anything wrong at all, you were murdered, and people were murdered by the millions. In blood was shed. Post-Stalinist, Russia, Soviet Russia, had changed enormously. And the way Kabakov talks about it, the kind of clash he sets up in the work and that existed in his life, in the beginning, during the Soviet Revolution, was hugely idealistic. It was in a backwards country where the czars had ruled with an iron hand, where huge amounts of the population were serfs, which was little better than slaves. And the revolution was to right those wrongs. And it was idealistic, and people believed in that. And the artist particularly believed in that. I mean, Lisitsky and Malevich and all of these constructivists, the first avant-garde of Soviet Russian art, if it's called, they did abstract art, art with enormous energy. They made these monuments for public squares and for the parades, and they believed in the Soviet dream.
The story is about Ilya Kabakov and Amelia Kabakov. Can you describe her role, how she is portrayed in the movie?
They were distant relatives. They found each other again when he came to the West and married. And first of all, she's like the Jean-Claude to his Christo. She's the one that gets it done. These works have become bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. He took over Monumenta, the Grand Palais in Paris. She's the one who makes that happen. But more and more, because it's a marriage, they've become collaborators in ideas and in everything, except, as she says, she can't paint.
You mentioned that during Stalin's time, if you did anything wrong, you were shot. What was something that was wrong?
Well, I mean, not just shot or sent to the gulag in Siberia or any number poisoned or any number of other things. Well, what was wrong could change. For instance, in the beginning, all of the farmland was made communal, and you were not allowed to have any of your own. But what turned out was that there was mass starvation for a lot of other reasons as well. And so to fix that, farmers were allowed to own their own land, and some of them became vastly wealthy. And then they were turned on, the kulaks, they were turned on and they were killed off. So it changed. It would change. And also the other thing is, within the Politburo, within the close circle of Stalin's friends and supporters, that was the most dangerous place of all to be. But I will tell you the other two parts of the three part later on.
Let's stay with the avant-garde of the first part of the Stalin era. What did their works of art look like?
It looked like various stages of abstraction. All over the world, abstraction was very much the art of the future, starting with Picasso and Braque's Cubism. Especially in Italy, the futurists thought that you could show or intimate in paint, in flat paint on a flat surface, this whole energy of locomotives and machines and life moving forward. So those forms were very much in the Soviet avant-garde. So Malevich, for instance, is most famous for the black square, which is a black square slightly off-center on a white background, which he always said was like an icon, and in fact, a black square hung over his bed when he died. And then he did other formations of squares and vectors and angles, and also with great energy shooting into the white, for which he had very mystical explanations. But then the constructivist sculptors did all that in three dimensions. And Toplin, for instance, made it a podium for Lenin to speak from, and which we show in the film, which spirals up and leans. And Kabakov interpreted that into an angel that goes up, 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 ladder, goes up, 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 up. And at the top, a man is reaching for an angel he cannot touch. He's made that in various versions, but the one in the film, there is no angel, there is only the sky, and Kabakov is explaining the three sections of life. So first there was the Stalin time when everybody's murdering everybody, then there was the time of hope, and then there was the time in which Kabakov was living, the Brezhnev time, in which all of the dreams of the beginning had become soured and ugly and disgusting, and life was terrible and unlivable in a very kind of dreary day-to-day way that was never going to change. And the discord between the immediate, the beginning of the great hope and the reality of what he lived is very much what the work is about.
As we move forward in the context of the movie in the 1990s, he is able to free himself from the Soviet reign and move to the United States.
When I first met Kabakov, I was working for a New York Newsday, which was going up against the Post and the Daily News, and they called us a tabloid and a tutu. And they sent me to Russia, to the Soviet Union, in 1987, because Perestroika, glasnost, in this country was being described as propaganda, and I talked them into sending me to see whether that was true in the arts, because I wrote about art. And so I wrote a five-part series that's about each of the arts, theater, film, art, etc. And in each one of them, the artists were being allowed to do things in 1987 they had never been allowed to do. Their films had been shelved for 20 years. The artists like Ilya Kabakov were never allowed to show the work in public. Suddenly they were being allowed to show, make movies and mount plays that had never been allowed before. And they were doing it, and they were so scared. So scared, because there had been an inkling of an opening under Khrushchev, and it had all gone backwards, and they were afraid of it. And I had heard of Kabakov, and I asked a woman who lived in a communal apartment and collected all these artists to bring me to his studio. And that's how I met him, and it was immediately clear what an amazing artist he was. And within a month, he had managed to get a visa to go to Graz for the first time to the West, to Austria, for his first Western exhibit. And by 1988, he was showing in New York. And by 1989, he had moved to America.
When we have a person, a skilled artist like Ilya Kabakov, and in the circumstances where he grew up in a hermetically sealed society of the Soviet Union at that time, what he represents, I'm interested in your perspective, is his interpretation of what is going on and how to reckon with it.
That is what his art is about. He found a way. Most of the other artists like him who were trying to make their own kind of art, because the official kind was socialist realism, where you showed how wonderful everything was, most of them had been looking at smuggled copies of Art Forum and Art in America, and where there were little, in those days, little black and white reproductions, and trying to make art like that as a way of having integrity. But he understood that the way to make art that had integrity was to analyze what was actually happening in the life of his society and to find a way to express it. That became his whole way of looking at art. He needed to find a way to express the internal psychological daily life of what he called Homo Sovieticus.
So when he's expressing that internal psychological life of the Homo Sovieticus, what other information does he draw upon beyond his own life experience?
Basically, he used the life around him. He used the life of the streets. He used little pieces of garbage. He had these little bits of, oh, maybe the top of a wine bottle, a piece of paper that signified something, or they didn't have paper clips. But, I mean, little pieces of things, and he would attach them to strings and then attach a little piece of paper that was a kind of memory or a cryptic saying or something out of his life to that, and he would string these across his studio, and that was really one of the first installations because people would walk between these strings. So he would use garbage. Garbage is a huge thing in his work. He would use the language of bureaucracy. He would make signs, and one of his most famous paintings, the one that in the film, another really great artist from that period, says that first painting, which is Answers of the Experimental Group, was to him like John Cage's silent piece, in which he keeps the piano silent and all you hear is the ambient sound. Because this painting was a painting as a bureaucratic chart. And in the chart, you see people saying different things in one band of the chart, or something official being said in official language in another. And then another part, he has hammered in a nail and hung a hanger. And there's a piece of a ball. And so that's his way, that the bureaucratic language had seeped into the most intimate part of the life of the Soviet Union.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with filmmaker Amai Wallach, who is the producer and director of Enter Here, a film that describes the life and the work and the history of Russian artist Ilya Kabakov and his wife, Amelia Kabakov. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Let's stay with this issue of within the hermetically sealed society. That can be analyzed, but until Ilya was able to leave the Soviet Union, what influenced him as to how things were then or could be beyond the borders of the Soviet Union?
Well, he was very, very aware that he was hermetically sealed. I mean, that was such a frustration to him because, like all really, really major artists, he had great ambition. And his ambition was to test himself against what he considered the great stream of European art history. He wanted to see how he measured up. And it was a very likely thing to worry about because, in fact, many of those artists doing that avant-garde underground art in their own little corners turned out not to be very interesting. But Ilya, from the moment he came to the West, was recognized as a major voice. And the thing that he dreamed of doing besides pitting himself against what was really good art to see whether he was making meaningful art was that when I was in his studio, leaned against the wall were all these like theater flats because his dream had been to make this enormous walk-through labyrinthine installation that the viewer would walk through and be confronted with all these stories. He's also a storyteller. He was earning his money as a book illustrator, and he loved this combination of word and image because, and how they could clash and how one thing would seem to be saying one thing and one thing would seem to be another. So the big thing he could do when he came to the U.S., when he came to the West, was to make these enormous installations. And the first one he did was at the Ronald Feldman Gallery in New York in 1988, and it was called 10 Characters. And he had done these albums, which were words and images, which he would perform in a studio by paging, going from page to page and reading the text in a monotone. So each of these 10 albums, or more or less, became a room in this communal apartment. Should I explain about a communal apartment?
Certainly. Many people have them in this country now, but perhaps in a different model.
You're right. So after the Soviet Revolution, lots and lots of these serfs moved to the city, and there was not room for them. So what they did was they would take an apartment that had belonged to a middle-class family, that either they grabbed it or the family had fled, and they would break it up. And so, you know, by 20 years later, you would have generations and generations of different families living in one apartment, and each family would have one room. They would share the corridor, and they would share this disgusting toilet and this horrible kitchen where there would be, you know, monumental World War III battles between people over things, and actually that also became the subject of one of Kabakov's installations. So he did this corridor with a bare light, dim light bulb, which would have been in that corridor, and in each of them was a room, and in each of them was the remnants of some mad dreamer aspect of Kabakov himself that who had left all these drawings and garbage and objects and that told his story. And also there were wall texts that told his story. And the most famous one, the one that's always reproduced and that's owned by the Pompidou Museum in Paris, which shows it often, is the man who flew into space from his apartment. And you can't go into this room. You look at it through these boarded up, badly boarded up thing that the police had put up there, because this man had papered his apartment with all these Soviet posters and all these, oh, isn't the Soviet wonderful things, and then he had made a catapult, and he had catapulted himself through the roof, and you can see the hole in the roof out of the apartment.
Your phrase a moment ago, to which you applied to Ilya Kabakov, the combination of word and image, invites me to ask the question to you, what prompted you to make this movie a combination of word and image, about Ilya and Emilia Kambakov?
Well, it's a long story. I admired his work since 1987. I came back to America and I wrote the first monograph on him. And then I went on as an art critic, and I began making a film with a filmmaker named Marion Cajori about an artist named Louise Bourgeois. And Marion died long before we could, we'd filmed for 14 years, but before we could make a film out of it. And so I had to learn to make a film with the wonderful editor, Ken Kobland, who is also the editor of this film. He's also an experimental filmmaker himself. And that film was opening in June 2008 at Film Forum in New York. And in June, Emilia said, "Well, you know, we're going to Moscow." Now, I knew that Kambakov had been afraid to go back to Russia all those years because he hated the Soviet Russia he had known. And also, he understood that the kernel of his art was rooted in that soil, and he was afraid the new Russia would disturb it. But they accepted an invitation to show at Dasha Zhukova's first contemporary art space, the garage, this huge space, and then they were invited to do installations all over Moscow, including the Pushkin Museum. So it was going to be a very, very big event. In the film, the Reuters reporter calls it an historic event. And I said, well, that's a film, and by the end of June, we were starting to film in Moscow.
Amai Wallach, producer and director of the film Enter Here, about the life of Ilya Kambakov and his wife, Emilia Kambakov. Tell us what you've learned about filmmaking.
Well, what I love about filmmaking is it's a form of collaging, that the form of the film and the logic of the film is not necessarily chronological. Think of, you know, films and flashbacks and all that. But it's really about the one scene you put next to the other scene resonating in a way that creates meaning. That's what I love about film. Now, in Ilya's case, I had a problem of telling three stories, or maybe more. One was a story of Soviet history, because that's so important in the art. The other was the story of his mother, because in very many ways, his mother's horrible life illuminates what that life was like. And also, the mother is at the heart of all the work. He says at one point, "I am my mother." And so that was very important. And so his life story with his mother's story, so that's two stories. And then, of course, the story of the art. And one of the most important things I like to do in film is to show the art as deeply, as beautifully, and in context as we possibly can. So I wanted to do those three things. In Ilya's case, I think the history became a much more, and Ilya's work is much more complex, became a much more complex part of the film. One of the things that was very important for Ilya to do, for instance, in these installations like 10 characters, you go into these rooms and you look at these objects, and in some way it connects to things in your life, your dreams, your disappointments. So it becomes a very personal connection. And that's the strength of the art.
In explaining the strength of the art, you have mentioned that Ilya's mother, in which he says, "I am my mother," that she had a horrible life. Tell us what was horrible about it.
She lived through the revolution. After the revolution, there's starvation in the Ukraine. This is because the Bolsheviks are taking all of the grain, and then the father starved to death. And so the mother had to take care of the children. Ilya was born in 1933. The husband didn't help in any way. You know, he beat her. He beat the child. It was quite terrible. The war came. The first thing that happened in June of 1941 in the Blitzkrieg was that the Germans bombed the town they lived in, Dniepropetrovsk. Those who didn't flee, who were Jewish, like Ilya's family, were fenestrated or killed in other ways. And then there was this harrowing journey that ended them up in Uzbekistan. And that is where, in fact, Ilya found the people who had the school, the Leningrad School of Art, which had been moved out of the siege of Leningrad, where the Germans were starving everybody in Leningrad to death, and he found them in Uzbekistan, and that was the beginning of his art life. But then when they could go back, he was assigned to the art school in Moscow, but it was a mess and the kids were defecating in the halls and all of this. But so she was not able to get a permit to live in Moscow. But she didn't have a permit, so she would drive into, would take train after train after train into Moscow. And finally, what she did was she became homeless, and she would rent a bed here or sleep in a toilet there or have a room here, or and all so that she could at least bring her son soup, and he was embarrassed for her, and it was a quite horrible life.
And there's an extensive portion of the film that reveals this.
Right.
Ame Wallach, I want to thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, would you please share with us an aha or eureka moment that has shaped your life?
My parents were German Jews, and they fled in 1938-39. My life, in many ways, has been a reckoning with that history. Well, there is a German artist named Anselm Kiefer, and his generation in the 1960s wanted to know, and they wanted to understand what had happened in Germany. And he put on Nazi uniform, or part of Nazi uniform. He went around to all these places that the Nazis had conquered, but also his own bathtub with a bottle of wine, because it was ironic, and he made the Nazi salute. And to me, that was an artist accepting in his own body his own history as a way to go on. And I thought that was something that has influenced everything in my life.
And can you tell us what you would like to do with the rest of your one precious life?
Well, I've just finished a book that has taken me years and years to write, and I'm starting another film. So with the rest of my life, I'd like to go on.
And finally, Ame Wallach, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
There is a writer named Lawrence Weschler, and he wrote a book called The Mirror in Bosnia. And it is about how that Dutch artist made art that was so still in the eye of a time that was even worse, he said, than Bosnia. It's a collection of essays, and that's the main essay.
Well, Ame Wallach, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed this.
Ame Wallach is the producer and director of the film Enter Here, the story of Ilya and Amelia Kabakov. Enter Here will be shown at the Mendocino Film Festival on May 31st, 2015 at 12:30 p.m. in the Village of Mendocino, California. The book that Ame Wallach recommends is Vermeer in Bosnia, Selected Writings by Lawrence Weschler. This program was recorded on May 10th, 2015. There are over 500 editions of Radio Curious on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free to listen, download, and share as you wish. The email address is curious@radiocurious.org or snail mail at 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah. That's UKIAH, California, 95482. And the phone is 707-462-6541. Christina Onnestad is the assistant producer, and I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.